Today is Saturday, 21st of February, 2009. This is LTUE. The panel is World Building 101.
Anyone who hasn't registered, remember to register in 1352. And this panel is called World Building 101, what every beginning writer needs to know. And it's going to be great. Let's give the mic over.
Hi, my name is Larry Correa, and I guess I'm going to be your moderator today because my name was put first, probably alphabetically. Okay, we're going to have a panel today about world building, and I'm going to pass the microphone down the line here so everyone can introduce themselves and say a little bit about who they are and what they write. So we'll go ahead and start down on this end.
I'm Kristen Randall. I am a young adult author, actually. I have been for quite some time. Perhaps as children you read my books in high school. I don't know. And this is my daughter, Charlotte, and she will introduce herself, but we're doing it together. Kind of. Maybe not now. Called Miko and the Lineage of the Dragon, which we will be on the shelf sometimes.
I'm Charlotte Randall. I am an archaeologist first and a author by opportunity and unfortunate passion and heritage. So, and I blame it all on her.
Unfortunate heritage?
No, unfortunate passion and heritage by chance.
I'm Larry Correa, and I am the author of a few books. My main one I'm known for is Monster Hunter International. It's coming out July 28th from Band. I actually self-published it last year. Got up to number 3 on the Entertainment Weekly bestseller list. And I did pretty well for a self-published book, and I got a contract with them. Yeah. And so I'm the guy that did everything wrong on how to get published and got published. So that's me. Looking forward to talk about world building. Got some different cool ideas about that. We'll just continue on down the line here.
I'm Stacey Whitman. I'm an editor of children's and young adult, mostly science fiction and fantasy, though I've done some mystery and historical fiction, speaking of the genre bending that we've talked about in previous sessions. I, up until August, was with Bear Stones, which is an imprint of Wizards of the Coast in Seattle, and now I'm a freelancer looking to acquire my first book for as a consulting editor for Tor, and as you can tell, I have a bit of a cold and I'm a little bit fuzzy. But I also do individual critiques with authors who are in the midst of submitting, so if you want more information, come up and talk to me later.
I'm Dan Willis, and I actually write for Mirror Stone. I wrote 3 books for them, and she edited my last book with them. My current book is with Wizards of the Coast Dragonlance property. It's called The Survivors. That came out in November. I didn't think they had any at the bookstore, but this is a series called Tracy Hickman Presents The Anvil of Time, and they have different people write for it. So I understand all my books were on his table. So if you bought a book from Tracy Hickman and he signed it, it looks like this. Have me sign it too. and it's kind of interesting that I'm on this panel because I write for Dragonlance, which Tracy actually built. But I have a few thoughts, so I'll keep up with the rest.
I am Anna Del Cidai. I do high fantasy, kind of like Tolkien style books. And my first books are a trilogy, the Silent Warrior trilogy. And no, I do not have a call. I do speak like this every day. I do have an accent. My English is my second language.
Okay, so getting right into our panel here, it's what every beginning writer needs to know about world building. So we're going to pose this question to the panel, and basically that's going to be when... Tell us a little about your worlds that you've created, and what makes them unique or special, or what you're proud of, and just some advice maybe for the people out there who are creating their own worlds, things that you've learned. So let's...
this is going to sound just really snotty, but the first step in building a world is being able to build a good sentence. So in case you're wondering, you actually want to be able to write well before you start putting together rocks and mountains. I'll let Charlotte talk about our own particular world.
Our particular world for this book that we were hoping to have out sent somewhere next year is based on medieval Japan. I have found personally in my own telling stories to myself, telling stories to people writing, I like to base my worlds on existing evidence of and base them in worlds that already do exist to a certain degree. Archaeologists are all basically storytellers when it comes down to it. We take physical evidence and construct a world that we hope is as close to reality as we can get. Of course, there's no way to know most of the time if we're right or not.
That's why we're going to show.
Exactly. So it's a really fun experience to be able to take physical evidence, in this case, what I know of medieval Japan, and turn it into a world where what I want to have happen is going to happen, but still within a fairly accurate historical context.
That also constrains you. You have to have rules. If you're writing a world, it's got to be constrained. If you're playing fast and loose with physics and with sociology to please your little plot, you're not really doing that plot. But if you can make a sense of place, a sense of solidity, a consistent topography, a consistent sociological structure, with a backstory, with a history, then telling the story, you're almost released by that, because then you know what your limits are, as you would be telling a story in our world, with our physics and our gravity and things like that. There's a certain amount of taking for granted you can do as you write, but you have to write within this constraint. It sounds like you're limited, but you're really not, because the story itself can become more important than the world that you write. We have everything from folklore to a real feathers, resounding feathers, down to actual places in Japan.
We brought stuff which we have in Korean mythology, and in case we did that in my last panel, Kirby gave this caveat over and over. If you're going to build a world that wants something that actually exists, please. First of all, please do your research, and don't do it on Wikipedia, also, please have the inner respect for your readers to tell them what you're doing, that so you don't present them this world that is credible because you've kept yourself to these rules, but it's not accurate. So, in a foreword or a historical note or anything, just to tell them what you're doing, so that the courtesy, so that they don't take what you say as law. I do that when I read. I read a book and I find myself just believing everything the author says, and I get done and I realize this person probably did zero back check. They changed stuff to fit what they liked. So,
with that caveat, when you read our book, please do not think that you can use it as a roadmap of Kyoto, because it won't work.
Well, I think that world building is important no matter whether you're building your own fantasy world out of scratch or if you're just changing one thing about the real world that we all live in. For example, let's look at the Hallowere series that I edited. It's a historical fantasy set right after the Civil War in our real world in Virginia, but it also has vampire fairies. So that's the one thing that we changed. And so we had to, the author especially, but I as the editor had to know enough about that time period and that locale to be able to fit the story within that. But there is a little bit of poetic license that can happen even when you're working in the real world. So it's just... I lost my train of thought.
We will have a session for questions.
Cole.
World building isn't just about physical, like drawing a map. If you're building, if you're starting, setting your story in a non-Earth world, world building really refers to your character. What's his world, her world like? setting it in our modern world, so you don't have to spend time discovering trade rocks, roads, and mailboxes, as bizarre. You still need to know what the reality of your characters are, what's the world that they are existing in. And you need to understand them as a character. That's an essential part of what I think a lot of people ignore. I'm building, or working on a series right now called Flux Engine, which is a YA steampunk story. I haven't done any steampunk, so I do a lot of research into the genre, which I really love. And those, that's sort of like historical fiction. It's also an alternate history, because it's set in this world, instead of the 1830s, 1840s, but Civil War period, because of, or pre-Civil War period, but because of the technology, there's all kinds of differences in that. And I had to understand how that world works, how it grew up, why things were the way they were at that time period, to understand where my story was and where it was going. And without that background detail, I wouldn't really know the politics, the things that are going on in the background. They're going to affect how the main character stories can play out. I really want to see a good example of this. I wrote for Dragonlance for years. Tracy developed this huge binder of background material on Dragonlance when he was working with Wizards of the Coast. And a lot of what's in there, which was like Legend of Huma, things like that, that have become books, were just background stories that he wrote. Little ideas, little bits and bobs about here's what we're going to, here's how the world became the world that it is. And knowing that information lets your world become rich, lets it seem alive. And that's homework that you really need to do if you want your story to be anything other than supernatural.
Can I just quickly add to that about Dragonlance? Because I edited Dragonlance, The New Adventures. And when a world has been around for 20 or 30 years, you end up with a library of world-building information. And so it actually becomes both easier and harder to write and edit within that world, because it's easier because you've got these resources right here, but you have to look at those resources and know them up and down and make sure that you're not conflicting with any of the 100 books that have already been written. And so it can be a challenge, but it's also kind of exciting because it leaves you open, I think, to focusing on character because you've got the world handed to you, and I don't know, would you agree with that? You've got the world already there, so you can say, how can my character interact with this world? And it can be a really interesting way of learning, of increasing your writing chops.
I have the easiest part of all of them because since my books are a fantasy and medieval style type era, I have a lot of medieval things already that have been done for me, so all I have to do is look at it and say, okay, I agree with this or I don't agree with this, and then add the fantasy part of it. And that is where I get to do whatever I please. It's fun. But at the same time, I do realize that you have to be true to your world. If you said in chapter one that your world is under the water, don't have somebody walking in a cliff or something in the second chapter. You have to be, you have to be one or the other. You can't have people swimming on the dirt. Okay, if your world is water, stay with that. Figure it out. Think about it. How is your characters are gonna walk there? Are they gonna walk? Are they gonna swim? What I'm trying to say? You need to figure it out what your character is gonna be doing and how it's gonna do it in the world you do. Create for them. And then stay true to it. Don't jump into things. That they have nothing to do with it, because as a reader, I wouldn't like it.
I'm a little bit different here in that my book is contemporary fantasy, meaning it takes place in our current world. Now, and I just tweaked one thing. As a rule of thumb, if you're going to write that kind of book, you have one set of rules that you decide to set aside, and that's going to be your fantastic element, but you damn well better make sure that everything works right. Okay. I apologize. I went to Utah State. why none of your Coca-Cola machines downstairs had caffeine. That's probably why. I apologize. Okay, now back to that, contemporary fantasy. You've got your one set of rules when you're setting up your universe, the thing that you're going to change. Now, in my book, in my universe, basically what I did is I took the reality of B-movies, if any of you guys are fans of B-monster movies and that kind of things, and I basically set up a world where that was the reality. Now, yeah, everything else is the same, but it's the reality of B-monster movies. Tomatoes could possibly eat you here. This could happen. Yeah, it's an evil day. Yeah. Sam Raimi is the man. Okay. Now, here's the thing, though. When you create a universe, you've got to set up your internal rules. There's nothing worse in the world as a reader if you're reading someone's book, and regardless of the genre, and they have their set of rules, and then they break their own rules. Can't have that. And just like, you know, internal rules here at BYU. Yeah, I will. Best thing to do, guys, here is when you set up your world, whether it's fantasy, science fiction, whatever it may be, you're going to have your universe codify what it is. If you have a universe that has magic, if you have a magic system in your reality, codify it. Make sure it makes sense. And be consistent. Be internally consistent. No matter what you do, you have to be internally consistent. So, now, I did see a couple hands popping up, and so, let's see, yes.
The internal consistency thing is very important, but sometimes you will want to break your own rules. You better have a really good reason for that, and something that really works for the story. There are stories where the whole point of the story is that you've got a world that is a certain way, but something's wrong, and it needs to be broken. And so the character's motivation comes from needing to break those rules. So rules can be broken, but they need a very good reason for it.
Yeah,
it
has to be organic way.
The
breaking
like
of the rules.
New rule that you discover.
Yeah, like it has to be something that you discover that's on top of or somehow. That, you know, it's like debate, or it's like what a lawyer would do in a courtroom. It has to work within the structure that you've got while somehow descending below it or ascending above it. And I don't know what you're talking about, because monsters break the rules. You have to have an internal world where nothing is... If a tomato can eat you, what kind of rules are you going to have?
I really like the term inevitable surprise, because you're setting it up to be a surprise, but the surprise that breaks the rules needs to seem inevitable as the reader looks back on the story.
Yeah. So that all of the elements work together to set up. And you've seen shows and read mysteries before where you have really kind of no clue what's going on. And at the end they do an aha. Like you're supposed to go, oh, it makes sense now. And instead you're going, oh, what?
There's a pretty famous webpage. It's actually pretty handy for a lot of people who are writers or trying to write, and it can point out a lot of traps you can fall into. It's a TV Tropes webpage. You guys all seen that? Okay.
Tropes.
Yeah, TV Tropes. And it's just a list of a bunch of things that different TV shows and books and video games and comic books, story elements that they use. Well, and I think one of the things we're talking about here is retconning. That's where you have your story and you have your internal set of rules, and then later on in another season, it becomes convenient to just totally violate your own history. Yeah, don't do that. Oh my gosh, that really, really bugs people.
Yeah, like one time I read a Mary Stuart novel. I think it was my brother Michael. I can't remember which one it was. But I read all of her stuff, and maybe you guys don't know her, but she was really fun to read. Anyway, she had this one book, and there was this guy who was following the protagonist around, and it was like really creeping you out. You didn't know what was going on. And then I think she was on a bus or something and finally decided to face him off. So she went up and sat by him, and he turned out to be her brother. It's a first-person story. She doesn't share that information with you before that point, and you're halfway through the book. You just think he's a stalker. The character knew. She knew it was her brother. She doesn't bother to tell you. Don't do stuff like that.
Oh, I don't know what she knows.
I'm suddenly seeing a novel where it's a guy traveling in time, retconning everything. That might be fun. I like this about my life, I'm going to change that. And I like this about someone else's life, I'm going to change that. But again, you have to know the rules before you break them. The other thing about establishing rules is that your consistency in your book, your readers are going to come to depend on that the world that you have built, that forms in their mind as they read, is a certain way. And if you violate that, then suddenly it's like you violated a trust with the reader. And when that happens, readers put the book down.
Yeah, you keep them out. You keep them out of the world by having, you made it really hard to say, schism.
Schism.
They get sucked right out like when a plane door comes off.
I know George R. R. Martin loves to kill people. Let me tell you something. You kill somebody I'm invested in, I'm putting the book down, I'm not picking it back up again. If you made me care about a character and you kill them for a stupid reason, I'm not coming back.
So the only people who you're allowed to kill are instant expendable?
No, but you might, if it's something you kill an important character, there better be a good reason for it that has to be stored.
You said it too!
I went to BYU, so I...
BYU is not responsible for the contents of this program.
I don't want to ask why in Puerto Rico.
Okay, I saw a couple hands come up. Do we have some questions? Yes, over here.
We spent some time talking about sociological and political world building.
Okay, for those of you in the back, she asked if we could talk about sociological and political world building. Actually, I do want to say something about that. The current project I'm working on right now is actually not a science fiction or fantasy project, but I'm working on a thriller. And my co-author is here. Shout out. Okay. Okay. Well, no, but in the talk about sociologically and politically, it's the same thing. If you're going to be setting up a world where things are a little bit different, you need to know beforehand what your political system is or what your conspiracy is. Basically, what we did is we just took the world of the conspiracy theories from all-night talk radio, coast to coast, that kind of thing, and made that reality. So
in your world, the tinfoil hat works.
Yes, surprisingly well. But it's actually set in a realistic world. It's just this text is kind of behind the scenes. It's the same thing socio-politically. Even in a fantasy world, your government's still going to have clerks. You know, people still need to sweep the streets, okay? So as far as sociologically, politically, I mean, you still have to have a system to function.
Once again, don't be afraid to build on things that already exist. As fun as it is to take things from scratch, a lot of people that I know who are trying to tell stories get themselves so muddled up in the details, they have no idea how to build these things. And we have an entire 2,000 plus years of civilized history, documented history, in which to look at structures of governments, social structures, everything. Base things on things that already exist. Well, exactly, and I mean, just use it even just to get ideas. I mean, you don't have to just completely pick up the Roman Empire and use it. These systems were built because they work, and they are credible. Well, they work for a certain period of time. You can break down most of them, but use what's already out there. If you get stuck, there's tons of reference material to go to. You don't have to make everything completely yourself.
One of my favorite worlds was built by Sharon Shin. Oh, if you guys have read her. Have you read her? Let me see who's read her. Oh, you guys, please. She wrote Archangel and Jehovah's Angel and a whole bunch of other things. And she set it on this world, Sumerian, and I can't tell you anything about it because none of you bothered to read it. She's wonderful. Uh-huh. Especially got a little bit of romance. But she has her whole social structure, her whole political structure, her whole religious structure, all very strong, all very consistent. And for that, you can go from book to book, and you can deal with the people on the higher levels of the social structure, and then there's a book that is about what's going on underneath all of that stuff. It's really fun because of the striations, the depth of it.
And I think it's important to remember that even if you're doing a personal story where you're not really getting into the politics of the world, you know, you're not meeting the president or the king, there are politics in the world that you're building for that character. There are sociological ties, family structures. Everything has a personal application as well. How does the world affect that character as much as how do the different armies affect each other?
Okay, I agree with what you were all saying. She was talking in the beginning, the cute girl. She was talking about history, and I think that's one of the best backgrounds that we have. We have how long have been men on Earth? How many civilizations has rise and fall? You study why they rise and why they fall, you can tweak it one way or another and create your own world. The other thing that I like to use also is religion. You know those Mormons? But anyway. Well, anyway, religion. If you look at the religion, different religion, you know, we're talking Orientals, any kind. If you study, you don't have to become them, okay? You don't have to go and baptize yourself. Just read their history, and you can see also why do they believe the way they believe? Why do they act the way they act? Why do they, you know, did what they did? And then you have right there more ideas. I mean, you're a writer. Use your imagination. Use the things that they are already there and change them a bit. Make your own, okay? Interchange them. You know, make them work for your character.
In some ways, I think world building can be a two-edged sword. I know I've seen stories, I've probably been to, where people are so proud of all the research they've done, all the detail they put into their world, they feel they need to put in another story. And while if you're writing a political thriller, we need to know what political system you're dealing with, why what's happening is happening, what the motivations, I mean, in any kind of mystery or suspense, you have to know motivations. Why are people doing what they're doing? Because that's where the suspense comes. Will so-and-so rise above their background and be the hero, or will they fall victim to their demons and let the world burn, or whatever. But if you're writing, you know, if you're writing Pinocchio, it doesn't matter what religion Geppetto is and who's the king. It's irrelevant. Now, if you know that stuff, great. But we don't need to know it in the story. And so you've got to be.
I agree with that.
Well, it didn't work for Disney.
but there's still a value system there, and he was assuming the same value system.
That's
well,
true.
And if you read Pinocchio, by the way, it's a completely different story.
Yeah, it was the first film. So, I think that's the basis from which everybody can.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is the actual story was written with a different, complete cultural bent, with a different
view.
And Disney took it and jerked it into the American purview, which tweaked the story. And you think you know Pinocchio, but you don't really.
Well, so then again, I totally can see the point, but my point is just that in this particular example,
a retelling world building as opposed to the original story.
Right. But then the idea here is just when you tell a story, details you don't need to know, you don't need to know. And even if you know those details, try to keep them out of the story. You know, give yourself enough research so that you know what's going on, so that you can see the big picture. But you're not going to give your readers all of it. It's like the farmer when only one cow came in from the field for the hay, he didn't give the cow the whole load. You know, give your readers what they need to go to get through your story and enjoy it without overloading it with meaningless facts.
That's one thing that when I'm reading books, I jump that part. When you get boring, you know, you're going on and on and on and on, and I'm going, so who cares? No? Give me the meat. Give me the dialogue. I want to see what is going on. It gets, it makes your story sometimes even to stop, so it gets in the way. And you don't want that. You lose your reader. And they are going to put your book down.
Yeah, and I think that it's important to just think in the terms of key details. As you're telling your story, you fill it out with key details, not entire paragraphs, but a sentence here. I'm going to go back to Halimir because it's a really great example to me of both real world building and fantasy world building. we had to know the technology of the time period. So, you know, was there indoor plumbing in a school in Virginia after the Civil War, you know? And what did they call certain kinds of dishes and stuff like that? And key details, as she's interacting with her environment and telling the story, she might reach for something and hand it to somebody across the table as they're conversing about something that's important to the story. It's just a detail. It just gives that sense of authenticity that the reader knows that you know what you're talking about, but you're not giving an info dump.
The gentleman right here had a question?
Yes. We've had a lot of exhortation to be consistent in our world, and I agree wholeheartedly. So my question is, how come we see such bad worlds in movies, such inconsistent worlds?
In movies? Okay, let me... Okay, for those of you, his question was, if consistency is so important, then why in movies do we see such poor consistency? I was going to just say Michael Bay.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Michael Bay.
But the explosions are very cool. Very cool explosions.
When you have layers of executives, things change.
Groupthink.
Yeah.
You've got the writer who wrote it in the first place, and the guy who took the screenplay, and the guy they got to replace him because he wasn't that easy to work with, and somebody wanted a different line, and then you got the guy who's directing it, who was on the scene in this scene. And pretty soon...
I want my daughter in it too. Well, at least G.I. Joe is back to being an American hero and not going to be an international force from Belgium. The in the pink shirt there, she had that question first.
Yeah, I know.
Go ahead.
You mentioned the key details are really important, and not using relevant ones. But if someone is writing a fantasy book where they're mostly building from scratch, what are most commonly the important details that they have to know before they start writing?
Okay, so if I got this right from the panel, what are the most important elements for fantasy world building? Is that what you... Like starting from scratch a fantasy world?
Are there toilets?
I will say the same thing that she just said. Use it as a part of the scene instead of dumping it all at once. Just, you know, just part of it, whatever you are creating. If you want everybody to know that in your world you do a toast before you go to bed, then have the characters dressed in their pajamas and doing a toast. Okay, but don't say, you know, in my world, we always have a toast before we go to bed. You see the difference?
I think that Philip Pullman is an excellent person to read for world building tips, especially if you've read the first book of his Dark Materials, The Golden Compass. Whatever your opinions on his politics, that is a beautifully written book, and the first sentence builds the word world for you in a sentence. I don't remember the exact wording of it, so you'll have to look it up. And I tried to find it for another panel, and I don't know where my book is. She's standing outside the door. Her father or her uncle, I can't remember, and her brother are arguing, and she's eavesdropping, and she turns to her demon and she says, "What's going on? What's a demon?" You know, you don't need to know all the details at once. As you create in your first chapters, you create those questions for the reader. What's a demon? Why is she standing outside the door? A door is a door unless it's, you know, a revolving door or something, you know. Or like what the door dilated, I think, is a famous science fiction. You know, you use key words to be able to express to your reader what's different without saying this is different from the real world, because that pulls them out of the world of your story. Just ease them into your world with those details of the things that you're making up, but don't dump it on them all at once. Create questions.
And if you're building a fantasy world, you really need to start with how is it like our world, because that's your common ground. If the trees are purple and bear fruit upside down and the grass is still green, then you've got some detail. The things that are the same as our world, you probably only need to give cursory attention to, because pretty much 90% of your readers are going to understand things that you don't say are different. They're going to make assumptions about your world based on what they know. It's where you start to have the differences that you have to start to build a fantasy world or any kind of world. And you start with culture, and from culture you grow into politics and society in general, trade, technology, things like that. Once you understand that, and I'm assuming that if your world building is public, you have a story in mind. I want to tell a story about a farmer who grows pigs in the ground. Okay, it's fine. Yeah, I've got to build a world to accommodate this.
Yes. So you know that you're planting them instead of...
It's a fantasy George Orwell. But,
write that down.
So if you know the story you want to tell, that should give you the scope of what you're dealing with. If it's a story about somebody in a small town worrying about saving the family farm, and you're not going to go on an epic quest and save the world from the evil overlord, then you may not even know who the evil overlord is or any of the rest of that. But if you're going to save the princess, save the world, then you better know who the princess is and why the world's in jeopardy.
Well, and pursuant to that, the about part, what is your conflict and what is your inevitable surprise? You need to have enough details around that particular thing that when the inevitable surprise comes, that's not the right word. It makes sense. So you need to know, are you dealing with social taboos that somehow have to be crossed to break the rules, to fix the thing that's wrong? You have to understand, what is it that's wrong? What is the conflict? What is it? Is it, do you have to travel, as he just said, to take the epic journey? And if so, then the details are in the journey. If it's a psychological kind of thing, if it's a sociological kind of thing, you got to have enough details that the conflict draws your audience in and creates enough tension in them that they understand what's going on and they're tense about it because they can anticipate that this might happen or that might happen. So that in the end, when something actually does happen, they're part of it.
Dan just reminded me, and I'm sure plenty of people in this room will know where this is from. Curse you for your surprising but inevitable betrayal. Yeah.
That's where the beginning is. The first episode of Firefly. Yeah. It's, the point is that your twist, whatever your second act twist is, it should be surprising yet inevitable. Your story should have, every indicator of your story should be pointing to it. And you should see, it's like the sixth sense. When you find out he's dead, spoiler alert, you should immediately be able to go, I knew that. I knew he was dead. All the signs pointed to it, even if you didn't realize it.
You go, oh!
That was the brilliance of that film. It was surprising.
And by the way, you don't do things in the order that he just did. You're going to do a spoiler alert. Please do it first.
Well, you know, it's a little late for that film, but I figured I was safe.
We actually had a question over here from that room. Go ahead.
Fantasy readers and authors love interesting worlds. I get sick of books that are 80% world, 20% plot. How do you balance that?
Okay, he said... he's sick of books that are 80% world, 20% plot. How do you balance that? Panel? I believe Dave's got that. I just met these people for the first time 2 minutes ago.
Yeah, I think that 20% world, 80% plot.
You tell your story. I mean, we've said over and over again, don't include every detail you know about your world.
That's what I was going to say earlier. But,
take them back.
No, they don't need to know. This goes along with giving them too much information, overloading them. The only world that's really relevant for your reader is what the characters are going to come across in what they're doing. There may occasionally have to be some kind of cultural setup, but and I'm going to admit this here, and I'll probably get ridiculed for it. I put down Robert Jordan's books, the first one after 40 pages of landscape description. I got so tired of it. I have no patience for it. I said, you know, I want to know who your character is and what he's doing. I don't
even did that with Tolkien. I didn't put down the book. I skipped the paragraph.
Yeah, that Council of Rivendell. I remember reading that going, okay, I'm turning page now. They're still talking. I'm turning page now.
Yeah, and then they're talking.
They're still talking!
And then when Boromir dies, it's Boromir got shot with an arrow, blew his horn, and died.
Yeah. I love Lord of the Rings, but there's a point in the Castle of Rivendell when Glowin, who I remember fondly from The Hobbit, which I read first, which probably spoiled the whole thing for me, stands up and he says, "I am Glowin, son of whoever he's the son of," and then he proceeds to tell the entire history of the Dwarven race. From the day they were created to that moment.
Does that remind you of the Book of Mormon in any way?
Yes, it does, and I'm getting to that. He does that by way of introduction of his son Gimli, who then stands up, "I am Gimli, son of Glowin," who proceeds to reiterate everything his father said until the moment his father sat down.
That's usually how I introduce myself.
"As Gimli, son of Glowin." You must be fun at parties.
Yes, go ahead.
This is actually a little specific for Stacy. What kind of world are you tired of seeing from an editorial perspective? Are you tired of
seeing? That's a really good question. Yes, I'm tired. Prepare to have your dreams.
Personally, I've worked on so many Tolkien-esque worlds in the last 3 years that high fantasy my elves are different than your elves. Create something different than elves, you know? Just because you named them something different doesn't mean they're not still elves as well.
They're elvish personally.
You... especially non-European cultures, when the writer knows what they're talking about with those cultures. Because cultural appropriation, not so much. But if you really do know those cultures and can speak from a place of authority, that's really interesting.
That's actually research again. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, like, the reason why I chose Japan is I lived there. I've studied there. I spent my whole undergraduate degree studying it, studying the history, the language, the culture. And so that's the only reason why I felt any authority at all. Well, and any, like, I had the right to touch it at all, so because I've been deeply involved with it. My next project is going to involve some Hopi and Zumi stuff, which absolutely terrifies me because
your next
I want to. Our next project. She's a panel in the same place with my car.
And Wales. We're doing Wales because she's there too.
How come I haven't been to India?
I think I'm only here for the grammar. But this is also, this has to do with how much detail do you include? She knows what the food tastes like, but she's not going to be telling you that in the book. It's as it moves too sometimes. But as we're writing this thing, and she's sharing these experiences with me, we're both writing from the standpoint of a very tactile experience with this culture, immersing ourselves in her experiences. They are her experiences. But we're not necessarily... And so then what happens in the writing is the tone of the writing. Really, a lot of it is in the language. The way the sentences are constructed, the things that people tend to speak to one another. We're mixing that with kind of an anime tradition, too. I mean, we're kind of seeing the whole thing as though it were being presented by in an anime form. So all of the dialogue and the details which we choose to share, these things all come across from an immersion, but into a simple storytelling. It's like setting up lighting if you're going to do a picture.
Something that Charlotte brought up that I want to make sure and make a caveat about is to be very, very careful that if you use anything from a Native American perspective, you either really, really know what you're talking about or you really make it fantasy. Because that is a very touchy subject, especially in children's literature. And you will get blogged about in a bad way by experts in the field.
Okay, we got a 5-minute warning, so I think this will probably be our last question. Go ahead.
My question went back to
actually kind of borders on that. Stacey, how does an editor approach a new world, especially if it's historical? Is that something that the editor has to do research on? Do they just depend on the author to know what they're doing?
I've been very lucky. I actually went to Scotland and the Hallinger series had a lot of Scottish and Celtic mythology involved. And I had been to Scotland and done a whole lot of research on it for just my own interest, and my author hadn't, so I was actually able to help her with that. I don't think it's necessary for the editor, but the thing about being an editor, it's not necessary for you to do all that research, but it's also the fun thing about being an editor is that you're constantly learning. And so if you, as an editor, are aware of the standards of research and know that in fantasy it's a lot easier than in nonfiction and realism, because you can take poetic license, but as long as you know that your author is doing their research and you know what standards you need to meet as far as any back matter, any references, that kind of a thing. And I just look at it and say, wow, cool, new culture that I can learn about, you know.
Let's go ahead and have our closing remarks from the panel.
This is the first time I get it first.
Sorry.
Make it beautiful. Don't go too long. Don't bore me with too much details. I do want to know some of it, but please don't give me all at once. Put it here, put it there, put it in the interaction of the characters and in the middle of the plot, whatever, but don't give me all at once, because I am going to jump it, I promise.
In your stories, the details that you want to tell, build beautiful worlds and let us experience them with your characters. Don't try to tell us all about the interesting political system you invented. Plus, it's really integral to the plot, and I can't imagine wanting to read the story where it was. But it's been a long time. There are some great, great stories that you guys will tell. There's some great worlds that you will build. Don't be intimidated. Speaking for myself, fantasy authors are lazy. That's one of the reasons why we invent our own worlds, because we don't have to study this one to learn how they all work. But in your world, if crossbows shoot faster or slower with more or less impact, that's your world. Make it any way you want. So have fun. Tell fun stories. You tell fun stories, people will meet.
And along with that, start with the story. The story is what's most important. Don't stress about the world building, but do be sure as you're revising, not in the first, you know, not letting... It's the whole, don't, we were talking about another panel, the whole dirty, the whole movie of throw the trade. Mm-hmm. How he spent the entire movie trying to come up with his first sentence. Don't do that with world building either. Allow it to become part of the process. If you can stop, say, I'm going to do some research, and keep going on your story. When you revise, between your revisions, when you set the manuscript aside, go do some research and come back to it fresh. The most interesting part of your story is your people, is the human element. So please tell me how your person moves within their world. So that involves understanding the rules of your world, having made a basis, but as everyone else has said, not telling me your world instead of telling me your story. I want to know how your people move within their sphere.
Read Sharon Shim. I'm going to disagree with all the people who said the first and most important thing is, because my first and most important thing is, please learn how to write before you expect me to get all the way through your book. I promise you I will read the first paragraph. And if you haven't got me, and if I have to stumble over your lengthy sentences and your many conjunctions and your misuse of the word which, I won't read any more of your book.
Who do I have to write with?
of scared now. So in conclusion, I guess that's it. Make a good world, make it interesting, make it fun, and we'll read it. And our names are down here at the bottom. Go to Amazon and purchase our books. Thank you very much.